except for Fiddler on the Roof and some ethnic jokes. The Shadchan, the marriage broker, has disappeared from Jewish life. I doubt seriously that there's anybody here this morning who met his or her mate at their engagement. Now, there are still many warm-hearted, busybodies who still invite the handsome, young, eligible over to dinner, and who somehow always seat him next to a very lovely, unmarried thing. But the choice is ours, to telephone or not to telephone. Now, historically, the right to choose a mate is relatively recently won. When Abraham grew old and feared that he was about to die, he was troubled about his son, the son of his old age, Isaac, for Isaac was unmarried. But instead of calling Isaac to him and saying, "Son, go out and find a wife," he summoned his steward, Eliezer, and he said to him, "Kiel artziv el moladati telech, vatikach isha livni liyakov." I want you to go to my ancestral home, to my native place, and I want you to find there a wife for my son Isaac. It was Eliezer, not Isaac, who found Rebecca. And so it has generally been, certainly until our fathers or our grandfathers or our great-grandfathers stepped out of the ghetto and out of the shtetl and into modern times. For 4,000 years, Jews were married off by their parents. And you know, it tended to work out. However monstrous or medieval the system seems today, I think it's only fair to say that any system of marriage arrangement which manages to last thousands of years must at least be functional. It must serve the needs of the society. And you know, the sequel to Abraham's story, I think, is the sequel to many of these arranged marriages, for the Bible tells us that when Isaac brought Rebekah into the tent of his mother and cohabited with her, the Bible adds the phrase, "Vayeha veha," and he came to love her. Social acceptance and social pressure led to companionship, companionship often to friendship, and friendship to love. The arch cynic of the 19th century, Mark Twain, who knew very few Jews, once remarked that the Jewish home is a home in the truest sense. Now, whatever Jews he knew in the middle of the 19th century were Jews whose marriages, I'm sure, had been arranged by their parents. And that romantic idyll that is so popular among non-Jews about the Jewish home, how stable it is, how warm it is, how emotionally comfortable it is, describes the homes of those whose marriages were brought together by society, by the family, by the marriage broker. And I wonder if our homes, with their tensions and their scrapping and the high rate of divorce that we have today, now that we have free choice, I wonder if our homes are in fact the best testimony that one could offer for the value of this particular freedom. Because I'm afraid that if we took any objective measurement, we'd have to say that though we can defend freedom of choice by certain a priori considerations, because we believe in individual autonomy and individual freedom, we cannot defend the results of falling in love, of free choice, because these are not defendable. The rates of divorce have gone up. The rates of squabbling and bitterness and angerness and frustration have all risen dramatically. And that famous Jewish home, so warm, so tender, so full of love, has become classically, now I'm afraid, a home full of tension and brittleness and sharp, bitter, caustic conversation. But somehow we look upon the arranged marriage, if not indulgently, bitterly. It seems medieval, archaic. And the reason for this is that we are children of a new age. The Industrial Revolution brought with it the concomitant political revolution. And the basis of the political revolutions in France, in England, in the United States, in Central Europe, was the dignity of the individual between man and the state. Locke and Kant particularly taught us one puts one's value on the dignity of man. Man has an autonomy which no corporate institution can dismiss out of hand. No one has a claim upon the individual beyond the individual itself. The old claims of religious sanction that were the basis of the ancient ethic, that God willed us to do this and willed that we not do that, had broken down. And now the philosophers, ethicians believed that if man had the ultimate responsibility, radical responsibility for his actions, if the ought was placed upon him, then he would rise to his obligations, he would accept that responsibility, and we would have a new free society of responsible people. So it was with Kant's categorical imperative and Locke's inalienable rights of the individual man. But as it worked out in practice, as far as marriage is concerned, it meant simply that one set falling in love above social considerations, above all the considerations which entered into the minds of families when they arranged the marriage of their youngsters. Questions which had to do with family background, with levels of education, with a kind of structure from which a young person emerged, the bundle of talents which he's had, his or her prospects. All these were dismissed as irrelevant. What was of concern was the urgency, the passion, the appetite, love. But unfortunately, in falling in love, we often lose our heads. And we often find ourselves falling in love with a person who is totally opposite to anything with which we are familiar, or a person whose value is higher in the eyes of the peer group than it will be in our eyes some years ahead. And so we have the large rise of unhappiness in marriage, which we can see all about us. But one thing I have noticed about modern divorce, or divorce American style, and it is this: that it tends to come 15, 18, 20 years into the marriage. It tends rarely to be bitter. A couple always says to me, you know, he's a right nice person, or she's a fine human being. And I rarely hear that at the base, the catalytic agent for the divorce is the charge of infidelity. Rather, what I hear is this kind of argument, this kind of self-understanding. You know, we have nothing in common anymore. He has his sports, he has his pipes, he has the kids. When I try to talk to him about other things, he's just disinterested. I don't know him really anymore, and he doesn't know me. It's as if we've grown into two other people. Well, perhaps life has led them to grow into being quite distinct people from what they were 15 or 20 years before at the altar. But perhaps they, at that moment at the altar, when love was in full cry, perhaps then they had very little in common, except their lust, their passion, their appetite for one another. Because if you try to talk to a young person today about similarities of family background, of educational level, of interests, cultural interests, they'll dismiss these as bunk, irrelevant. Don't talk to me about these extrinsic values. What counts is that our relationship is honest, it's genuine, it's fulfilling now. It's immediate. But you know, whenever the sociologists have studied the breakup rate of marriage, they have found that in marriages between people, one of whom has dropped out of high school and the other of whom has graduated from college, one of whom comes from a tradition of family loyalty and family living, and the other whom comes from a tradition in which the family has played a relatively small role in their upbringing. One of whom comes from one religious structure and one of whom comes from another religious structure, they find that the rates of divorce increase markedly, measurably. So there must be something to the old concept of compatibility. When we're young and when we're inexperienced and when we are excited in the flush of our passion, to talk of compatibility, to talk of these extrinsic factors in marriage simply is to be turned off, to be dismissed out of hand. What then shall we say about love and marriage? Is there a way to live in our modern society where there is freedom of choice? The shadchan will never be resurrected from the scrap bin of medieval functionaries. Is there a way to bring marriage and love into juxtaposition? The first group to deal with this problem were, of course, the aristocrats, the kings, the nobles, the powerful who walked the earth. And their solution was simple. They made a radical separation between marriage and love. To the aristocrats of all times, the important element was to protect title, to protect property, to protect privilege. And so they arranged the marriages of princes and princesses, of the rich and the richer, in order to maintain their status and their power and their wealth and their position. Now, they had the leisure for love. They had an opportunity to grow into human beings. And so, by and large, aristocratic societies always winked upon the extramarital. The Oras created a world in which the two young people had been brought together. God willing, they should fall in love, but if they didn't, David would find his Bathsheba, the motor company heiress would find her movie star. And no one would really cast aspersions upon this. There'd be no moral sanction, because the important thing was the possession, the property, the status of the family, and these were assured. Now, interestingly, our fathers in the shtetl had a very aristocratic system of marriage arrangement. What did the marriage broker talk about when he brought the two families together? The word was yichus. And what is yichus? It's wealth, it's position, it's power, it's family status. And you know, there's very little difference in form between the ksuba, the marriage contract, and the 100 and some odd provisions of the marriage contract that Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis has with her multi-billionaire. The only difference is that the ksuba dealt with pillows and blankets and Shabbos candles, and hers deals with emerald bracelets and yachts and oil wells and such things. But the real difference between our fathers and the aristocrats of the world is our fathers were aristocrats of the spirit. And they took the seventh commandment seriously. They looked upon adultery, all extramarital undertakings, as blasphemous sin. And you know, they managed surprisingly to live with honesty and loyalty within the terms of their marriage. And the important element to them is not simply that it was a sin against God, against God's law, but that the ultimate sin that any man can or woman can undertake is to treat property as if it's more important than a person, to treat wealth as if it's more important than a human being. Marriage was first and foremost a relationship between two people. It was kiddushin. It was something very sacred between individuals. And if anything is more important than the relationship of individuals, our faith does not admit it. And so the investment that you were asked to make into the marriage was not simply the few things that the young couple would have in common, but the emotions, the life, the feeling, the care, the concern. These were sacralized, declared to be sacred, to be binding, and necessarily eternal. And the experience of centuries would seem to indicate
that all the psychologists and all the writers and all of the free spirits of our time to the contrary, that two people can live a lifetime together in love and fidelity without great frustration, without missing any of the ecstasy or bliss that's available to man. Now, the poor of the world had no chance to allow love to grow. Marriage was simply an arrangement which had to do with survival. One had children because children were necessary for the field, for the home. One worked together and slaved together, and marriage was a yoke. It gave some physical relief, but more important, it created a partnership which made for the peasants of the world survival feasible. So the aristocrats of the world separate love and marriage. The peasants of the world have no opportunity to really understand what love is all about. And we come to the strange conclusion, strange because it runs counter to so much of the ballyhoo which we hear about us, that the middle class is conservative, it's unromantic, it has no sense of life, of excitement. We've come to the strange conclusion that the idea that marriage and love can be run hand in hand is a creation of the middle class and of middle class psychology. The middle class grew in modern times, and the middle class grew at a time when the Bible was a moving document in history. The Bible taught something about human freedom. The Bible taught a great deal about the respect and dignity one human being should show to another. The Bible spoke of fidelity and attacked adultery, and harlotry was the greatest of sin. And the new middle class had freedom and had some abundance. It had enough free time, enough opportunity to grow into a defined person and to begin to expose and to understand the sensitivities of emotion and feeling which must bud if love is to grow. And it understood something about the responsibilities of family, of fidelity. It was very respectable. The youngsters would say very square. But interestingly, only if you're square can you really be in love, but more of that in a moment. The middle class had this opportunity, and it began to speak of marriage and love as synonymous. One was expected to marry someone with whom one was in love, and this love was expected to grow and to deepen. And one was to treat another human being not as an it, someone one married because they brought a large dowry, a piece of land our family needed. And one was not to treat the extramarital as an it, as a sex object, as a play boy or play girl, somebody one used and then abused and threw away. One was to treat the individual in that person's sacredness. One was to turn to another person and to open up and to build on love that which is larger than the physical, that which is the love which is spiritual, which is total, which embraces all of the capacities of one human being to share friendship and intimacy and attention and silence and feeling and the depths of concern with another human being. It is the middle class which produces the first literature of in which love and marriage are assumed to be synonymous, in which the tension comes because there is not love in marriage, or because one falls out of love in marriage. Now there's a possibility to bind the two together. And it's proven to be exciting, and many marriages prove it to be possible, but our society imposes terrible obstacles in the way. Marriage today, the marriage which is love-based and honestly entered, faces a number of very serious new emotional and spiritual obstacles. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that we find the increase in the race of divorce and marriage breakup. It isn't simply the speed with which we live our lives, but it has to do with some other things. The first of these, I think, is extrinsic, outside of the marriage relationship. We look to the marriage for intimacy, for companionship, for understanding. We expected a great deal of the relationship. And when the middle class first emerged, the middle class lived in towns, and they tended to be rooted to a certain environment, and they tended to have a number of relationships outside the marriage relationships, which were basic and essential. The woman had a whole group of other women with whom she entered into voluntary activities. Cakes were brought from family to family. There was solicitude, real, honest friendship between home and home. And the woman had a whole series of female friends who were friends in a very deep sense.
And the man had his
business associates, his professional associates, the people with whom he engaged in the town and civic undertaking. They had been born together and raised together. They were tied together by any number of emotional, deep, lasting ties. And so though a great deal was expected of the marriage relationship, not everything was expected of it. But today,
as the pace of life has increased,
the family has been reduced.
We now immediately leave our parents' homes when we marry, and usually our parents' city. We leave behind, in our
search for our profession, the friends of our childhood. And those are the most lasting, usually, of friendships. A professional man, a businessman, will often make 5 or 6 changes of location in the course of his active career.
The minute our children are 16, 17, 18, and graduate from high school, they leave the home. And the result is that we are desperately lonely. The only marriage, only relationship which is truly portable, which can move with us from place to place, is the marriage relationship. And so we today tend to demand more of the marriage relationship than I believe it can, in fact, permit us or afford us. Every marriage needs a series of releases, of times away, of fulfilling moments of companionship and friendship which are outside the bond between the two. It's not a form of disloyalty at all. It's a form of release. It's a form of finding people who share the interests in our marriage which we cannot totally share with our husband and our wife. But because of the speed of our life, because of the mobility of the society in which we live, we tend to demand so much of a marriage that merry marriages seem to be breaking up not because too little is demanded of them, not because people are indifferent to the other, but because they cannot find all that they need. They're demanding too much. And the other problem, I think, which uniquely faces the modern marriage is the fact that we have moved from a middle-class society, square, conservative, to a post-middle-class society, perhaps a proletarian society, where again everything must be out in the open. Sex is the basis of any good marriage. But we have turned sex into athleticism. We have turned sex into a barnyard activity, which is supposed to have no emotional overtones. We sell by means of sex. Our society is permeated by the erotic. And as a result, the slow discovery of another human being, the awareness which comes as you exchange intimacy, as you fumble to understand the depths of another, as you fumble to understand the meaning of passion, to learn to live physically with another human being as well as intellectually and emotionally and as a family, that has disappeared. And we are told in a sense that sex is something apart from marriage. You can have it before marriage and aside from the marriage and after marriage. And what does marriage become? It becomes, I suppose, a temporary arrangement which is satisfying as long as the athletic exercise of the night is satisfying. But that's not a marriage. A marriage is a lasting agreement of companionship. It is an agreement which begins in love and should last into the years when physical intimacy is no longer possible. It's a relationship which should be strong enough so that it can take the times when we feel estranged from, alien to, distant from our partner, and know that these times will pass and that we will come back together and that we will somehow re-knit our lives, perhaps in a new way, but re-knit them nevertheless. But because of this emphasis on the sexual, on the ecstatic, on the erotic, which you find on every bookshelf, in every movie, in every television, in every conversation, a concept of freedom which is really anarchy, not freedom at all. We are in danger, many of us, of losing the sensitivity, the slow, necessary period of growth at the beginning of a marriage, which solidifies. Rabbis used to say that the altar itself bewails when a man divorces the bride of his youth, because no relationship will ever have the same context. When you're young and immature and uncertain, and your partner is young and immature and uncertain, you share the silence, you share the anxiety, you share the experimentation, you share the sudden awareness, and ties are knit which are deep and which can be lasting. But when you come into the marriage in terms as an expert in all that is sexual, mating with another expert who is in all that is sexual, all you are two experts in all that is sexual. And that's not what a marriage is all about. You don't need a marriage for that. I don't know what the future of marriage will be in this post-middle-class age of ours. Marriage is put under tremendous tension by the new kind of radical insistence on a radical freedom, which is really an insistence on a freedom which is lawless, beyond law. I don't believe that society can long survive the disintegration of marriage, because it is in the home that the child is formed, the child learns to love, and that he really or she really learns to live with other human beings. And it's in the home that we learn to become human beings. Business, a profession, in a sense, turns a man or a woman into something that's just a little more callous than they were before. We have to be callous to certain things in the outside world in order to survive. But in the home, we can't possibly be callous, brutal, inhuman. We have to be open. We have to share. We have to sacrifice. We learn what it means to suffer and to care. We know what it means to have vicarious feelings, to be satisfied with the success of another, and to be hurt by the failure of another. It's not that we need marriage simply for the feeding and care of good children. We need marriage for the humanization of adults. Now, whether marriage will survive will depend upon many things, but most of all on our own sensitivity, our own concern. The roles of women and of men are changing. The economic pressures upon a family are increasing manifold. A city is becoming a torturous place in which to live. Mobility is destroying the context of lives so that we are always, in a sense, anonymous integers moving from place to place. If we let loose of the family, I'm afraid we let loose of one of the last bastions of sanity in our world. And those who are encouraged to believe that they can be full and free and independent, and that they really don't need marriage, that marriage is something beyond the necessary undertakings of people, that it is restrictive, I think they will find that not only is life lonely for them, but they are turned away and walled in and what life is really all about, and the deeper emotions, and the deeper sensitivities. In our tradition, marriage is sacred, it's designed to last a lifetime. The marriage partners are to be helpmates, each to the other. It's very easy to wax romantic when one ends a sermon on marriage about all the beauties and possibilities that are in a love relationship, and they are many. But I think today it's more important to speak of the perils and the dangers and the frustrations which are inevitable in every marriage, and to remind ourselves that it is through frustration, through all of these tensions, that we grow. So that when we are faced by them, as we have been and will be, we don't immediately throw up our hands and say, here's a get. No. Get out of my life. I'm going to find a new basis for life. That's the child's way. You won't play the game my way. I'll take my bat and find another ball field and another team. The way of adults is to make a relationship work. It's the way of determination. It's a rewarding way. But it demands sacrifice and maturity and a great, great deal of emotional sensitivity. Amen.